Hello, Diddly Dum. This is Peter Capaldi. I play the Doctor. Diddly Dum, 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 Diddly Dum.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 85 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there, and the 18th best podcast per se in Brazil. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Alan.
I do like how you all always remember which order to respond in, because it's in the rigid class hierarchical system that is the Diddly Dum podcast. So, has anything interesting at all been happening in our lives since last we addressed the Faithless Sisters?
Well, my book's coming out on the 16th of October.
Oh, right. And which book is this, Aidan? He said with fake naivety.
Interest.
Well. Take interest. Oh. And this book is?
So this is Child Out of Time, Growing Up with Doctor Who in the Wilderness Years. And this is all... Sorry, I just realised that I just put on my newsreading voice there. This is a journey through the wilderness years as told through the eyes of myself as a, well, as a young boy.
Rather than through the eyes of a jaded middle-aged man like me and Doc.
Outrageous.
Tell me, Hayden, how easy was it for you to imagine yourself into the headspace of a young boy? Cast your mind back all of a week, did you?
So Child Out of Time is a personal story about how I discovered Doctor Who as a 7-year-old boy around, well, actually the same weekend as the TV movie was released, and talks about growing up while the show was off the air and how I survived. And it's had some lovely contributions from such illustrious writers as Andrew Smith and Paul Mars. And it's coming out on the 16th of October. It'll be available from Amazon and also from all good bookstores as well.
Splendid, splendid.
And there should be an advanced copy in all of your pigeonholes in the Whoseum hallway, so...
Oh, I'll look forward to that. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
No problem. Go and buy it.
Don't have to now.
Yeah, exactly.
I may be popping up in a few podcasting places, let's say, as well.
You had a captive audience of three, and you've just given the book to...
If we each get a complimentary copy, doesn't that halve your readership, Hayden?
Oh, ye of little faith, Doc. Oh, ye of little faith. About 12, at the very least.
One for every year of your life.
Funnily enough, I mean, I've been working on it for on and off for 3 years, and it's starting to feel a little bit real, so I think I'm a little bit sort of nervous about it going out there into the big wide world. Aww. It's kind of like a child going off to university. I feel like it's flying the nest.
As you may have picked up from certain hints of the last few podcast listeners, Aidan's manuscript was proofread by yours truly. So, whereas I'd like to say that I'm really looking forward to reading it, if I close my eyes, it's imprinted on that on the inside of my eyelids.
Wow, you really do need new glasses. Can I read the blurb for the book? Okay, so... For 26 years, Doctor Who was a British institution, capturing the imaginations of generations of children. But then in 1989, it was cancelled. The Doctor and his on-screen adventures were no more. There was no longer a hero, a champion for the outcasts, who struggled to fit in. It was as though he had walked into his TARDIS and set his controls for dematerialization, never to return. A whole generation lost to the powers of science fiction's greatest creation. It was in this doctorless world that I grew up. This is the story of how one little boy would try to find the Doctor in any way, shape, or form, and the obstacles he faced in doing so. This is the story of growing up without Doctor Who in the wilderness years, and how I lived through it. Dun dun dun. Dun dun dun. Dun dun dun. Yes.
Yes, I don't think I've ever heard someone sound so much like Richard Burton, Hayden.
It's interesting, of course, that growing up in a doctorless world in Britain is a tragedy, whereas in America it's called being working class.
Dear, dear. Well, we'll talk about this, the book a little more in podcast 86, I think, once Mark and Alan had a chance to read it. Anything been happening in your lives, gentlemen? Mark and Alan?
Well, I noticed on Twitter over last week it was National Podcast Day, and I would just like to say a couple of podcasts gave us a shout out on Twitter.
Oh, that was nice.
New to Who podcast.
Yes, that was generous of them, wasn't it?
Are they the ones in favour of an asexual doctor? New to Who podcast.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, that's quite good.
Yes. Yes, new to Who and Blue Box podcast as well. Both gave us shout outs for that.
Who? So. Who?
Yeah, didn't the Blue Box podcast say that we were nostalgic?
Yeah, to be honest, they did a list. They did one word descriptions of all the podcasts they mentioned and lots of.
Nostalgic?
Thoughtful, funny, insightful, but we got nostalgic.
How can we be nostalgic? Hayden's not even been born yet.
Don't you remember those recent podcasts we did where we looked back on all those Series 10 episodes?
I tell you what it probably might be. It might be nostalgic for things like
Jubblies.
Bagpuss and the Clangers and Jubblies. It may well just as
common
be
sense.
It's their version of us saying the fourth best podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's carefully calculated to cause the maximum insecurity of people who hear it. What do they mean? What are they saying? I'm quite shocked they still listen to us.
But yeah, anyway, I thought it was nice to get shout-outs from those two.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you kindly, gentlemen.
Alan, you've been talking a lot about conventions in the last week or so. What have you been up to?
Well, unfortunately, we had to pull out of attending the Epsom convention. My wife, Erica, one of her colleagues at work, sadly passed away last Friday. She was discovered at home. having suffered a heart attack. And yeah, but unfortunately it meant Eric had to pick up some of the slack work-wise, so we were supposed to be in Epsom, which is a shame.
I was going to say, you were supposed to be interviewing Prentice Hancock, weren't you?
I was, unfortunately.
Oh, he had to pull out anyway because he was ill.
Oh, really? Oh,
well, I've never seen Alan Lear and Prentice Hancock in the same room together at the same time.
That's unusual.
Mm. That's because you weren't at Polarity Day.
Oh, good point.
In terms of conventions, what we have been doing is that we have now paid the deposit on the hall and have launched the Who at Hoylake convention. Ooh. Which will be on the Saturday, the 28th of July next year. It's a one-day convention. We've had a bit of a rush announcement today. At 7 o'clock, we announced a couple of spot prizes for the first people who've booked tickets. The first few guests have been announced. Toby Haydoke is going to be a special guest with us on the interviewing team.
Hey!
We've got Philip Hinchcliffe has said he's definitely coming. And just today, we've also had a confirmation of attendance from a certain Mr. Michael Troughton.
Wow.
Yeah. Because he not only wrote, but also read aloud the biography of his father.
Mm.
And I am going to be very interested to find out how that was for him emotionally, coming to sort of read the part of his father when he came to do the Audible or the book version. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him. If anyone's at all interested, it's £45 for an adult, £25 for anyone under 16. Anyone under 5 gets in free. The price of admission includes at least 2 autographs from every guest.
Oh. Mm.
I say that now. We may be having a sponsored guest who will, of course, operate under the rules of the sponsor.
Mm.
But with the guests we've booked, you get 2 autographs.
So I can get in for free then?
As an under 5, Hayden, yes, you can.
Fantastic.
You have to be accompanied by a responsible adult, though, so fortunately.
Well, that rules you three out, then.
Yeah. You'll have to come with Toby. It's the only solution. Yeah, so the link's in the show notes, I hope, but the address is www.who@hoylake.co.uk.
And whereabouts is Hoylake, please?
Hoylake is on the Wirral. It's in the posh bit of Merseyside, with lovely views out to the North Welsh coast. So if we get a sunny day, it'll be very...
That's part of the world I haven't been to, so that'll be very nice.
You're from North Wales. How can you not have been to
I'm
the
from
Wirral?
South Wales.
No civilization.
Is there a divide? There's a divide.
There is very much a divide.
The posh bit of Merseyside is a bit like saying the tatty bit of Mayfair, isn't it?
Well, the Wirral was originally part of Cheshire, and Merseyside was created in 1974, 1975, by the Local Authority Act, ever since when it's been part of Merseyside, along with Liverpool, which used to be Lancashire. So that's been it. And the other thing that's happened recently is that the Doctor Who Appreciation Society have released the fourth volume of Cosmic Mask, which is their free-to-download magazine, fanzine thing, which includes fan fiction. An author called Hayden Gribble has a story in this edition.
I've never heard of him.
No, I believe he's not.
Yet. Hang on.
That's obviously a pseudonym.
Not the Gribble. Hayden Gribble.
No, just a Hayden Gribble.
Not Hayden Gribble, the author of A Child Out of Time.
Oh, it
which
may
is
be,
priced actually, very reasonably in all your good local bookshops.
Yes.
Please go to www.haydengribble.net for all the latest news.
That always used to make me laugh when they used to say on TV advertisement for things like, we've just launched the first issue of Doctor Who Weekly in 1977, was it? 79? Yeah.
I remember it well.
It would appear on television in a brief commercial and it would say, available at all good newsagents. As if a newsagent would be looking at that thing, oh, I better stop, I wasn't going to stop that, I better do it now in case people think I'm not a good newsagent.
Yeah, it is. It's funny terminology, isn't it? Very weird. Going back to the Cosmic Mask issue, it was utterly brilliant.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah.
Honestly, one of the best written Doctor Who fanzine issues I've ever read, honest. The fact that 20% of that is from Alan himself probably does wonders for it, but...
You're very kind.
No, it's glorious.
Perhaps you ought to explain to our listeners what it is, because I had no idea before I'd heard it.
Right, it's a free downloadable fanzine. You can get it from the Doctor Who Appreciation Society website, www.dwasonline.co.uk.
Links in the show notes.
It and its three previous companion volumes. And it's basically a collection of reviews and fan fiction and opinion pieces. It's like an extended celestial toy room.
Toy room.
I always make that. And it includes all the same sort of material, but it's not on the strict monthly time frame. So because it's download, we get more space to play around. So you get the fan fiction, which is actually all rather good in this episode, in this issue, I have to say, with one glaring exception.
You shouldn't be too hard on yourself, Alan, don't worry.
There's even a pompous little joke hidden away in the Greek lettering, if you that way. So it's well worth checking out, especially if you're into some of your more niche bits of Whovenalia, would be the term, I suppose, fandom.
Whovenalia?
Whovenalia, very good, I like that, yeah. Whovenalia, more obscure niche things like the colorization process. There have been articles on that, and articles on the sort of highly technical aspects of bringing a show like Doctor Who or its merchandise out. There's a lot more, ironically, there's a lot more focus on badges and toys and things like that than there is in the Celestial Toy Room itself. But if you're interested in the marginalia of Whovenalia, it's definitely worth it, especially this time round, because apart from anything else, it's got a truly glorious cover.
Oh, yes. Yeah, but I was just about to mention that. Yeah. Try finding the Sixth Doctor on this cover, by the way.
Mm. Yes, yeah, it's quite a good one, that, isn't it?
Yeah. And the first person to tweet us with the correct location of the Sixth Doctor on the front cover will receive a signed Kit Kat from all four of us.
What have you been doing, Doc?
What have you been up to, Doc?
Well, funny you should ask me. Aho, which is Latin for alas. The run of the episodes of When the Boat Comes In finished last weekend. So I'm bereft of things to do on the drama channel. But a couple of weekends ago, season four is a bit of a letdown, really. It's one of those ones that they finished it, they decided to try and revive it, and it didn't work too well. But episode five of it, an episode called Oh My Charming Billy Boy, it's sort of standard trope story of a poor mining family who send their youngest son to grammar school. He goes on to Oxford, where there's the standard story, you know, the conflict between his common roots and all the toffs he meets there.
That's the story of your entry into the civil service, isn't it, Doc?
Yes, it is, actually. I was watching this, and we're introduced to his grammar school teacher, who sponsored him for his scholarship. And blow me if he isn't played by Iron Gron, David Dacre.
Yeah.
Shortly after, we were introduced to his tutor at Oxford, and it's played by Cardinal Barusa, Angus Mackay.
Really?
Mackay. And later, we're introduced to his girlfriend's granddad, who used to be a college servant at Oxford, and as we know, no one's more snobbish than servants.
Mm.
Door opens, in walks Mavic Chen.
Hey!
Kevin Stoney, I can believe it!
Packer!
Isn't there a legacy option in Oxford whereby the son of a domestic...
A college scout.
Can sit for interview.
Happens in... Does it happen in the History Boys, is it?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
And then, as if all that wasn't enough, the main character in this show, played by James Bolam, is friends with this local family, and he's always popping round to see them, to hobnob with them. And the patriarch of that family always had a vague notion that he looks familiar, but I couldn't work it out. I suppose all I needed to do was go on Google, but I couldn't be bothered. And the penny finally dropped the other day that he's played by none other than James Garbutt, who is better known in Genesis of the Daleks as
the arch traitor, the Thal spy, Bronson.
So, it's unbelievable. It's almost like, we knew it was, wasn't it? It's a sort of repertory company of decent character actors bestriding the 70s. Oh, gosh, I've just been checking on the internet. Guess what's succeeding it on the drama channel? This really is bringing the 70s back. The Duchess of Duke Street, which was the debut TV performance for a very young Lala Ward.
Really?
Yeah,
she turns out whose ambition is to be an opera singer. And so her mum sort of crowbars the opportunity for her to sing into half the episodes of the final series. Oh, and dear. It's like fingernails on blackboards. It's not supposed to be. I just don't think Lala Ward's got a really good singing voice.
It used to come on television on Saturdays after Doctor Who, didn't it? Duchess of Duke Street.
Yes, it did. It used to be between Doctor Who and Saturday Night at the Movies, didn't it? It's quite good, actually. It sort of pales towards the end of the second series. Oh, and isn't the French chef who teaches her how to cook played by Castellan Spandrel? I think it is. Lordy. So I'll probably be watching that, if only for the opportunity to spy out former Doctor Who Illuminati.
Did I tell you guys a couple of months ago, that the same weekend... Oh, good. The weekend that Roger Moore died, or around the time Roger Moore died, that weekend I watched True Entertainment for the first time, and it was an episode of The Persuaders. And the episode that I watched had none other than Patrick Troughton in it.
Yay!
Ooh. And I'd never really watched The Persuaders, because I think it was repeated on Channel 4 in the mid-90s, I think. Yeah. And I remember my dad saying to me, oh, you'll like this, because James Bond is in it. And it just went over my head, I think. But I watched this episode, and I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. I was thoroughly dismayed that there was only one series to catch up on. So when I get the time, I'm going to be catching up on The Persuaders. Yeah, Patrick Troughton plays a German count, a Nazi. He's on the hunt for a Nazi antique, I think it was, from what I remember. And his goons are trying to kill off Tony Curtis throughout the episode. And yeah, Roger Moore's sort of bumbling his way through it as well. But it's just absolutely delightful. I suppose my big screen and small screen heroes as well, literally on the same screen together. Brilliant. I'll have to look up the episode name, actually, there.
You sound like a member of the escape committee in Stalag Luft 15. We must keep an eye out for the goons. Either that or a radio listener in the 50s.
That sounded more like Lady Constance the Coverlet.
It's sort of Lala Ward singing. I don't suppose anyone... It's very difficult because... Are you aware of BritBox, which is like a kind of... it's a TV channel that's available abroad. But obviously, if you mess around with your VPN, you can get it in this country. And they show loads of classic British television. And they've started to show sometime in the last week a recon of The Wheel in Space.
Oh, I heard about this.
Produced by the restoration team. The audio spruced up as usual by Mark Ayres. And I think using some of the loose canon footage, although not actually animated, just stills from it, I think. I haven't had a chance to see it. I didn't know if anyone else had.
No, I completely forgot about it, actually. Because I think they announced it, didn't they, Mark, at the, was it San Diego Comic Con?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I live for the day when one of these foreign people is going to get the wrong end of the stick and have the audio reconstructed by Pam Ayres. Oh, Davros, we meet again. What have you to say for yourself? Oh, I wish I'd looked after me teeth.
You mean Pampas Ford Aylesbury, surely?
Just for your reference, the episode with Patrick Troughton in it is called The Old, The New and The Deadly.
I recently picked up the Doctor Who special edition referencing the Doctor, which is a very good read that I can recommend if you're into the Doctor Who non-fiction books.
Oh, the magazine special edition.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, the magazine special edition. Yeah, it's really good. Details everything from Malcolm Hulk's and Terence Dick's first making of Doctor Who book, right up until the one by Simon...
Guerrier,
the Paper Dolls book. So it covers everything from there, including, you know, all the Radio Times anniversary specials, the Peter Haining books, all the Howard Stammers Walkers. And, it's a really interesting read.
Didn't we meet him at Capital 2? I thought you bought a paperback from him that said he...
Oh, Simon Guerrier, yes, I did, yes. That's right, I did.
Dalek in the front page.
Yes, I bought one of his Black Archives books, the one about the evil of Daleks, and he drew a little doodle of a Dalek and BB-8 in there for me. He was a very nice man. My other little tune nugget that I got is it's a bit of feedback from a listener, i.e. my friend Nick, who listens to the podcast while he's commuting and also at night when he can't sleep. And
high praise indeed, Mark. High praise indeed.
Absolutely.
That doesn't last long, does it?
We are the new shipping forecast. Anyway, he put the podcast on his iPhone and was trying to listen to it on the train, and he couldn't hear it, so he kept turning it up. And I'll read you the message. I'm on the train listening to the Diddly Dum podcast and thought it wasn't working as I couldn't hear it. Turns out I hadn't plugged my headphones in, and the whole carriage can hear Terence Dick's impressions emanating from my phone. Thanks, Diddly Dum.
Excuse me. Who's been impersonating Terence Dix?
Yeah, so our listenership quadrupled in that moment.
It's quite a quiet carriage. I do sometimes think that if I ever forgot to ask at the beginning of one of these podcasts, what have we been up to since last we assembled, gentlemen? That's about half an hour, these podcasts. But getting to the point of everything, we have assembled at the museum today, gentlemen, have we not, to discuss Vengeance on Varos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We have.
Season 22 stories. Was it the third story of Colin Baker's run?
It was, and the second story of season 22 as well.
Broadcast in January 1985. Writer Philip Martin. Director Ron Jones, a rarity. Script editor Eric Saywood. Producer, of course, John Nathan Turner. Mm. Would anyone like to make a stab at it, Mrs.?
I think I've gone last, or barely at all, last couple of times. So, I suppose I should say something for once.
I thought our ratings had been going up recently.
Well, as you know, I've been watching classic Doctor Who with my friend Ed, who's not a Doctor Who fan. He hasn't watched it. He's 43. He's not watched it since it was on telly, since the 70s and early 80s. We watched Caesar Doom, which he enjoyed, Brain of Morbius, and then I watched Genesis of the Daleks with him. Genesis of the Daleks went down an absolute storm, and I have to say, it's one of those stories...
Oh, yes, I remember you telling us you're planning to.
Yeah, it's one of those stories that I've seen so often myself, and because I've read so much about it and I've listened to various podcasts about it, listened to a lot of very well-reasoned criticism of its flaws and plot holes and why it's not the classic and why it's overrated, that I'd sort of become slightly jaded by it in a way. But watching it, sitting down and watching it with my friend Ed for the first time, who had none of this knowledge and garbage going around in his mind about it, and seeing it through fresh eyes, it was exhilarating. He absolutely loved it. Every time we hit a cliffhanger, he was like, "Wow, that's incredible. I can't put the next episode on quick. Let's watch that." He loved it. The set pieces, like the people dying at the start, the Doctor's big long speech still really worked for him, because I know that gets a lot of stick these days, doesn't it? People saying it's not really a moral dilemma, blah, blah, blah. And enjoying the performance of Davros, Michael Wisher, Peter Miles and Tom Baker, and enjoying the plot twists. It just brought it to life anew for me, and it was sensational viewing. It was almost like watching it for the first time myself. So that was brilliant. So I thought, well, I'll try an experiment. And I spoke to him today. We watched it this afternoon. I said to him, would you mind sitting down and watching a couple of episodes of a Colin Baker story with me? I didn't tell him they were 45-minute episodes.
So you thought, Mark, this was such a brilliant experience with him, watching Genesis of the Daleks, that it could only be downhill from here on in. So you better end it all by showing him a Colin story.
Well, I thought that perhaps watching this with a friend as well, I might enjoy it, because my memories of Colin Baker stories, I haven't watched any Colin Baker since the VHS releases, which I brought and watched.
Bloody hell.
So, you know, we're talking like 20 years here for some of these. I just never really enjoyed that era at the time. And I was pretty much, if I'd watched it by myself, I would have just been sitting there thinking, well, yeah, this is kind of what I expected. Typical sort of mid to late 80s, that era of Doctor Who. At the time, I didn't like it at all. And I thought, well, at least if I'm watching it with my friend Ed, we can have a good laugh at it together. And that'll be something for me to talk about, how it contrasts so badly with Genesis and the Daleks. And we can talk about that on the podcast. And actually, that isn't really how it panned out.
Yeah.
Ed really enjoyed it. And watching it with him, again, I was watching it with his eyes, I guess. It seemed much newer and more exciting than I'd imagined it would do. I mean, his opinions on things were just so contrary to my own sort of and perceived fan wisdom. The titles and the music, he was like, oh, this is great. He loved that version of the music, and he loved the titles because they were so incredibly 80s and they reminded him of Top of the Pops. And then Colin Baker appeared on screen. I said in a very leading way, that costume, eh? And Ed went, yeah, it's really good, isn't it, actually? That really works, doesn't it? I said, what? Because it's like a harlequin, like a clown. And it's, why can't the Doctor be like that? You know, he goes through all these regenerations, have these various outfits. That's fine, it's good. I like it, it's wacky. And I thought, oh, okay.
So we already know that you've now been watching Doctor Who with
a blind madman,
a refugee from an insane asylum. I thought he was going to see, what about the costume, mate? He was going to say, yeah, does she look great in blue shorts?
Oh, well, yeah, he was spellbound by Perpigillian Brown, to be honest. In fact, when I left him, he was merrily Googling Nicola Bryant.
I've not heard it called that before.
I normally merrily Google her when she's actually on the screen, but there you go.
Yes, he'd retired to his bunk.
Oh, a Firefly reference. Very nice.
Good catch. We watched that episode last night.
At War Stories.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting that he felt that the outfit was wacky and a Jester's Motley sort of thing, because, of course, arguably Colin Baker's is the least wacky of the Doctors.
Hmm. But he enjoyed Colin Baker's performance as well, as did I, actually. I do remember at the time liking Colin Baker a lot more than I liked Sylvester McCoy when he first arrived. And, yeah, we just sat down, we watched both episodes. I think it helped that it was one of the Doctor Who episodes that's got a bit more substance, isn't it? In that it's got a writer trying to do something, trying to say something. Whereas, you know, some episodes are just basic, more of a sci-fi adventure. They don't really have the quite as deep or perhaps as obvious a subtext as this one does. Of course, this is written by Philip Martin, isn't it? Who wrote, who created the TV show Gangsters. I don't know if anyone's seen that, have they?
It's got, oh, what's his name? The guy who plays Lytton.
Yes, it, yes.
In it, in Attack of the Cybermen and, Resurrection of the Daleks, yeah. I've forgotten his name, Maurice Colburn, there you go.
And it's quite, it's a very gritty series. I think first there was a one-off episode was made in 76, and then they commissioned a, like a mini-series, I think, of six episodes, which was shown in early 78. And I've seen the one-off, but I haven't seen the mini-series, but I understand that it does a lot of sort of meta work and does a lot of breaking the fourth wall. It's quite experimental as a mini-series.
Whenever I hear somebody say, no, it's whenever I hear people talk about breaking the fourth wall as an interesting experiment, I remember that the first instance I've come across, the earliest instance I've come across, is in fact Toby Belch doing it in Twelfth Night. When they're in the middle of playing tricks upon Mercutio, Toby Belch turns to the audience and says, well, if this were a play upon a stage, likely it would not be believed! So it's a 400-year-old experiment.
Well, yeah, but TV's...
TV is more conservative than stage.
Yeah. And you can see that happening. You can see that sort of playing with the... would I be right to use the word metatextuality? Would that be right?
Yes.
Playing with the metatextuality. And you can see him doing that in Vengeance on Varos as well, can't you? I mean, from things, little things like Perry saying all these corridors look the same. And all the way through to the rather excellently scripted cliffhanger where they're watching the death of the Doctor on the TV screen. And they say, that's it, close in on his death throes and cut. And then the music comes in. And that's very much a Philip Martin touch.
Interestingly, Alan, you know, you said that you found it was quite new when Toby Belch was doing it in Twelfth Night.
Yes.
Do you know what, when I first came across it, was when it was done by the third member of the chorus on the left in the Frogs of Aristophanes.
Really?
So, really?
Of course, that was before my time.
It's actually a 2,400-year-old trope. So.
Those Greeks, eh?
Metatextuality, Mark.
Yeah.
You were talking about. God, this sounds like being with Al again. It's about Greek theatre and me desperately Googling it while he's talking to her. What the hell is he talking about?
It's that sort of postmodern kind of...
It's self-referential, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's referencing the text within the text.
Mm. It's something which modern TV does quite a lot, especially comedies, stuff like Rick and Morty and Community. They tend to do it quite a lot. And I think this story, yeah, Mark's right. It's very metatextual, but it's also, well, I don't know whether I should start running with this or not, but it's a real mismatch of a very gritty, very tough storyline, whilst also at the same time looking so cheap. And I know that that's an easy argument to say against something which is 30-odd years old, but it just, it is, it's...
As long as you don't say about things that are 50 years old.
Well, something which I think the 80s really does badly, Doctor Who in the 80s does really badly is lighting.
Yes.
Oh, obviously, yeah.
Something the 80s really does badly. Oh, music, fashion, politics.
Oh, don't get me started. But the lighting in it's just, it should be dark and moody. It should have the sort of, they're underground, aren't they? For most of it. So, in my mind, it should look, have that really like dank and horrid feel of something like, I don't know, Talents of Wen Chiang. You know, when they're down in the sewers, that kind of thing. I know that's hard to step up for 90 minutes overall, but at the same time, it just glares out of the screen. You know, that moment when they're sort of, they're confronted by that that image of the giant wasp or fly, aren't they?
Mm.
There's that horrific sort of fluorescent pink. God, it's so garish. And it's slightly distracting. I mean, on the surface of it, Vengeance on Varos is a very good script. And it's very well acted, too, I thought.
Well, apart from Jason Connery.
Well, actually, yes.
How
yes,
did he ever get Robin of Sherwood after that?
Yeah. Was this his first TV appearance?
Anyone would think he had a famous dad or something.
Well, you must admit, when I first When the episode starts and he's sort of chained half naked to the wall and being... I start thinking, this is a bit gratuitous, isn't it? But I agree with what you said about Colin in this. Colin Baker's very good in this, but what does him down is that really overlong scene in the TARDIS right at the very start where he comes across a really dismissive, unlikable doctor. As soon as he steps out of the TARDIS, he is the doctor and he's a very, I would say, likeable. I liked Colin Baker in this.
Well, he's sulking early on, though, isn't he? Because the TARDIS has stopped working, so...
Yeah, yeah. But it's the actual... It's what Philip Martin's been given to work with, is this whole sort of backstory that JNT was working in, that this Doctor's going to be very unlikable, very brash, very moody, very unpredictable at the very start of his reign, and we're going to soften him up as time goes on. Completely, obviously, you know, time has correctly judged that that was the wrong thing to do. But I wondered, actually, whether I found Colin more likeable, or the Sixth Doctor more likeable, because we've had a more grumpy and sort of irascible and at times unlikable Doctor in the form of Peter Capaldi since. I wonder whether, retrospectively, that has actually softened the characterisation of the Sixth Doctor.
I was just going to say, you know, you say, of course, in retrospect, we all think it was a mistake. Everyone thinks it was such a big mistake that they promptly did it again.
Yeah.
I think it could have been an interesting idea. I just don't think they quite got the right handle on it.
No. No, but do you think that because we've had a Doctor similar in some ways to the Sixth Doctor since then, do you think that that may have... I don't know, we may have got used to... Do you think that we find the Sixth Doctor more agreeable now that we've had the 12th?
No.
Oh. Mark, what do you think?
Possibly, although he's quite callous, isn't he, in this? I mean, there's moments, isn't there, like Into the TARDIS, where the 12th Doctor can appear quite callous. But here it's sort of callous and played for laughs, isn't it? Which is an odd combination for the Doctor. It makes him come across as very cold. I think Gary Gillett makes a reference to this. I was reading his late 90s book, The A to Z of Doctor Who, recently. And there's a section in there on violence in Doctor Who. And he makes the point that the fact that the Doctor makes jokes, excuse me for not joining you, which is sort of slightly sort of James Bond.
Roger Moore, James Bondy, yeah.
It's perhaps a misstep, and perhaps they do focus a little bit too much on the gore and the violence without any of the light, and the Doctor doesn't appear to...
You'll forgive me if I don't join you.
Thank you.
Alan, we were just saying, do you think that having the 12th Doctor come along has softened the 6th Doctor retrospectively?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? I wonder if perhaps having sort of seen it worked out with Peter Capaldi, having been done as it was planned, going from grumpy to softer and more affable, more relatable, and for it actually to happen... rather than be interrupted by a hiatus and then kicked off prematurely before the turnover to a nicer Doctor was ever fully realised. I wonder if perhaps having seen it done, we can look back with a better sense of what was supposed to be achieved with Colin Baker's Doctor. Yes, yeah, I think you might be right.
No, because I don't think it was done properly with Peter Capaldi. It's not that they got it wrong with Colin and they didn't give him enough time to reach the end of this character development arc. It was just a bloody silly idea in the first place. What was successful about Peter Capaldi in his final season is not, look how he's developed from grumpy into being nicer with Bill. It's just they stopped the bloody stupid idea, that was a stupid idea in the first place, and started making him just being decent with people. I thought it was a terrible idea making him... Yes, you make him dark... You make him slightly grumpy in the way that the Fourth Doctor was with his companions in his early years. But not... You see, the problem with Colin, he wasn't really grumpy. He was a combination of sulky, arrogant and aggressive.
Yeah.
There was nothing likeable in there.
But I think, nevertheless, and I appreciate what you're saying, Doc, but I think the point still stands that Colin never got the rapprochement at the end that Peter Capaldi got, where, as you say, he turns into a proper Doctor who's actually nice to be around. Because of the machinations behind the scenes, Colin Baker's Doctor got stuck in grumpy, irascible twat mode forevermore.
Apart from the audio adventures and things which came afterwards, which obviously not experienced by as many people.
Indeed, of course, and which...
Still a terrible idea to think of, to start with. Let's imagine that Colin had done, say, a full 7 years. And, I don't know, for the first two, he'd been a grumpy git. For the middle three, he'd been calming down. And in the final two, he'd been really, really nice. I suppose that's possibly an interesting character development arc, but it's not nowhere near interesting enough to justify him being an arsehole for 2 years.
Didn't they do that anyway with the first Doctor?
And yeah, and much better, because he was a grumpy old man. He was an irritable old man,
yeah,
as old men can get. I know you've no experience of this yourselves.
I'm doing a podcast.
But I just didn't like it at all. And at least when Peter Capaldi is doing it, it's a very intimate and small examination of doing it. When Colin was doing it, the show is still at the stage where the acting is still half stagey, half televisiony. And so it's much broader. And so you're just thinking, oh, what a twat. Just stop doing it. It's like, let's say that we've decided new Doctor comes along and he's really he or she's really aggressive and spends the first, his or her first, oh, it's going to be awful saying this, isn't it, from now on? His or her, their first season, walking around with a gun in his pocket, shooting everyone he sees. And then he spends the second season in terrible remorse, learning how bad it is to go around shooting people. And then the third series, the Doctor is against guns again. I mean, I wouldn't even find that interesting at all. But even if it had found it interesting, it wouldn't be nearly interesting enough to justify the Doctor going around shooting people for a year. It's just not interesting. If you want to come up with a character art for the Doctor, come up with something more interesting than him just being an aggressive, arrogant git. No, to answer your question, Mark, that opening scene of the two of them in the TARDIS, I didn't feel any better for it. I just thought, this is absolutely dreadful. Just get it out of this, where I stick a couple of chopsticks in my eyes and twiddle them around to try and take the image away from it. But after that, once he comes out of the TARDIS, you're saying he's perfectly likable. So one of you was saying.
Hayden was saying, yeah.
I think so. Well, his whole attitude just changes, doesn't it, really? He's a bit more sort of... It seems that the Sixth Doctor seems to work better when he's in the adventure. But it's just a shame that around this time, they seem to think that the character building moments were quiet moments in the TARDIS, which all they're doing is just deconstructing any likability that you may have for this new Doctor. I mean, I can't imagine watching Vengeance on Varus or any of his run, actually, during the 80s, because it's just so... I don't know what it is, but sometime halfway during sort of Peter Davison's run, the Doctor Who does start to look a little bit out of place. You know, when you watch anything else from around the time, and it's... I don't know whether it's the budgets or the way that the show was being filmed or anything like that. And these aren't new arguments that I'm putting out there or new criticisms at all. There's nothing original in this whatsoever. But the show at this point, I think if I had have been the target audience in the mid 80s, I would have switched off, I think, by this point, because I would have felt like Doctor Who was just starting to look a bit tired.
For me, as somebody who'd watched it religiously every week, it had certainly gone from being something I had to see to, well, you know, if there's nothing else on, I might watch it. A lot of these, the Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy stories, I probably didn't catch until they came out on VHS later on, because I'd lost interest. But that might have been my age.
There's a lack of confidence.
Yeah.
So what you're saying yes to? His age or lack of confidence?
It may have been his age, I'm thinking. What do you mean by lack of confidence?
Well, I know it's easy to overpraise the Hinchcliffe Holmes era, but there's a sense there that the actors are really... You've got something like Brain of Morbius. The actors are really chewing the scenery. Not only are they taking the most ridiculous possible ideas absolutely seriously, they're really really decent actors who you can imagine Maren burning you to death because you'd pissed her off.
Mm.
You can imagine Solon chopping your head off because he was a nutter. And there's a confidence in the writing, I think, and in the performance that carries you through. Yes, it carries you through knowing that it's a skit of Frankenstein. But something like Vengeance on Varos, and it's not a story I'm going to slag off, but it seems... Martin Jarvis is a good actor, but he's not a chew-the-scenery actor, is he?
He plays it quite quietly, doesn't he?
Hmm.
One of the most tedious characters I find in sort of Doctor Who is, who's a character like the Governor, is John Woodnut playing the Martian. John Woodvine, who I really like in things like... What was that one we were talking about the other day, Matt? About things like Knights of God.
Yes.
But he's quite boring. He's just not at the stand. He's just staring into a mirror and grumbling. Blah, blah, blah. But you could really believe he will press the button and launch those nuclear missiles, can't you?
Mm.
With Martin Jarvis in that sort of... There's nothing more 80s about this show than that grey leather uniform he wears as the Governor. And there are quite dark moments where he actually, despite being ostensibly a nice guy who's put upon as the Governor, does things like quite openly says, all right, well, who can we torture to death in an interesting way to distract the voters from my policies? And he's not doing it, you know, regretfully. He's quite clearly doing it very cynically. But I can't quite believe it.
Mm.
And it's possibly the lighting.
I think the problem with the lighting, perhaps, is actually in the story. Because, of course, everything's supposed to be watchable on television, even the Governor's office and that sort of thing. So it's all very, very brightly lit because it's all supposed to be visible on the screen. But as you say, it undermines the effectiveness of some of it.
I also wonder if from the end of Tom Baker's reign, maybe up until perhaps midway into Sylvester, you know, that maybe Sylvester's final season, we lose the idea of there being sort of an element of darkness about the Doctor. Not darkness as in wickedness, but I've said before, I think Peter Davison is just, he's too bland for me, his performance as the Doctor. Colin is just...
Too far the other way, perhaps?
Yes, and too erratic. Hmm. He's just crazy. He's not darkly dangerous, as Tom can sometimes be. He's just a nutter. Sylvester is a sort of a comic fool until he settles down.
Hmm.
In his last year. And I just find it's hard to take seriously. Plus, between Romana and K-9 leave at the end of Warrior's Gate, don't they?
Yeah.
I'm sure you can if you're a young kid who's only just been introduced and you've grown up with them, but after Romana leaves, what's the first companion that you feel you genuinely care whether they live or die?
Turlough.
Yeah. I mean, Perry is abominable in this. And not even abominable assassins like Turlough, who you feel you shouldn't like him because he's plotting against the Doctor.
Mm.
And he's a bit of a coward. Perry is just annoying.
I put a lot of that down to the accent that was forced upon her.
Definitely, yeah.
I think that's her equivalent of Colin Baker's costume, really.
It's a very good accent. She's very consistent with it, but
yeah,
it is very annoying it's as an accent.
Consistently annoying.
Yes. That sort of Valley Girl thing, really quite
irritating. And she's also the only companion, I think, throughout the whole run of Doctor Who I just think, what are you doing there?
Mm.
Why would you be travelling? Why would you be sticking around with this guy? Why would you be travelling around with him? You're not seeing the delight, you know. I know it's more of a sort of a modern day thing for the companions to be sort of shown the wonders of the universe. But the Doctor isn't even doing this. He isn't even doing that with her. You know, she really has. Apart from a quick trip to Seville in The Two Doctors, I can't actually think of any other... He takes her to a funeral in Revelation of the Daleks, doesn't he?
Hmm.
Yes.
He takes her to... That's probably it. That's as good as it gets.
One wonders if she stays with him out of a sense of guilt over the fact she's costing his life. But if so, it's not really explored, is it?
No.
And then, Of course, the failure there to explain what she's doing with the Doctor is only compounded by the even more inexplicable manner in which she leaves.
Yeah.
I thought it was a particular failure as well. I mean, clearly, some people just haven't got the memo with Perry about what a backstory is. I thought it was a particular failure at the end of this episode, where she goes stumbling towards the poisonous forest, as if Philip Martin's forgotten that she's a botanist.
Well, that's down to the...
Yes, of course.
That's a good point, but that'd be the story editor's fault, really, wouldn't it?
Yes,
probably. The script editor's fault, more than Philip Martin.
So, yes, it would have been Eric up to them to correct the continuity, won't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
I'm fully prepared to accept that this is because when I first saw those stories, I was a kid. And so it wasn't suspension, you know, it wasn't me suspending disbelief. I was absolutely convinced and enthralled by it. But I would be genuinely worried that the mummies were going to kill Sarah.
Yeah.
I was even genuinely worried that Romana 1 would fall off that cliff.
You'd be genuinely worried that Sarah Jane was going to fall off the telescope. Not the telescope. The bit in Genesis. Off the side of the rocket, yeah. Yeah, the rocket
side. General von Klinkerhoffen would just let her drop.
Yeah.
And I find Perry's thing turning into a bird just mildly diverting.
Mm.
If that. Who genuinely cares what happens to her when she disappears in Trial of the Time Lord?
Mm.
And it's not me being nasty or bitchy.
As I say, more than usual. Apparently not even the writers, judging by the way they got round.
So. Yes, yes. But, having said all that...
Is she the 80s dodo?
She does literally turn into a dodo. So.
For a story starring possibly the most irritating TARDIS team of all, I think it is surprisingly good.
Yeah.
I don't know who got this idea that a grumpy egotist preening before a sulky whinging companion was just what Doctor Who needed. Sounds more like the draft proposal for the Diddly Dumb podcast for me. The only thing that could save the Doctor Perry relationship for me is if the dialogue had some sparkle to it. But it doesn't. When they're bitching towards each other, she's... And Doctor, and he's... There's not even saying it in clever ways to each other. No. The trouble is that there is no relationship between them.
No, there isn't. Stage. No, you're right. And actually...
She just whinges at him, and he just attitudinalises at her.
The absolute nadir of their relationship is during the first part of The Two Doctors, when she sort of says silently to herself the word arsehole. When he said... I can't remember what he says, but they're arguing in the TARDIS, and she sort of mimes the word arsehole.
It's saying quite something, isn't it, that when two people... first meet, one of them attempts to throttle the other, and Hayden stood there going, don't worry, it's all downhill from here.
Yeah, absolutely. God, it's Generation X, my friend, we're not afraid of anything.
Was Perry this whiny in her two stories with Peter?
She's a tiny bit at the start of Androzani, isn't she, when she's sort of saying, oh, can we go somewhere else? But, you know... I think you can kind of forgive that. I don't know. I mean, they I've heard Colin Baker say in interviews that apparently the dialogue that they received for the first two stories in the Trial of the Time Lord season was... It was along the same lines, but they just chose to perform it differently, you know, and they were sort of, there was more of an affection there because of the way that they chose to do it. But should it really be... I don't know. I mean... It gets to such a point that the actors are saying, well, no, we have to do it a different way. This just clearly isn't working. I mean, considering that Colin and Nicola are great friends in real life, it's such a shame that that never really came over in this season. And I mean, this season's probably arguably the most scrutinised out of any in Doctor Who history, isn't it? Because this really was when the BBC was turning its back on the show. Mm. You know, you had... people writing in about this story as well. It's, you know, the Radio Times letters page and points of view. We're talking about how disgraceful it was to see such, you know, violent content with regards to, you know, genetic experiments and hangings and acid baths. And it wasn't just Mary Wyatt basically talking about it at this point.
That guy who falls into the acid bath and then... reaches out, that moment where he reaches out and you get close-up of him all burnt and scarred. I mean, that is genuinely horrific. That's made my friend who was watching it with recoil slightly.
Mm.
even today.
Of course, there is the sort of the typical failure of the chattering idiots who watch television recreation as though there was nothing better to do with it, to turn around and say, oh, isn't it awful how this satire on violence to be being used as entertainment is so violent?
Yeah. But this is where the show was at that point. You know, you had an actor in the role that there were members of the actual production team who were not confident in his abilities. He had a completely tasteless outfit. This is the show very much, or JNT, you know, at the height of his confidence with the programme. But it's not very... It is, isn't it? Because this is 2 years on from the 20th anniversary. And there was a feeling on the show that they could do absolutely anything. And they got it wrong. Fair play to them. They've all said ever since, you know, oh, no, we got this all wrong. But there's too much turbulence surrounding this period of Doctor Who to watch this without having to acknowledge what was going on behind the scenes. Which is why it's so nice to see that Mark's friend watched it with fresh eyes without knowing all of the behind the scenes turbulence, as it were, and really got a lot out of it.
Yeah, he did. He said it was thought-provoking stuff. He said a lot of the issues he felt were still being quite relevant today. The violence on TV and a lot of the politics as well. Trade deals and having to kowtow to people to try to get the best trade deal and the things that you'll do and go through to try to save your position in government. A lot of these things are still very relevant today.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way, the referendum's almost like David...
Yes.
Dave Cameron's almost like the governor sitting in the chair saying, vote now, and if I fail, then I'm going to be bombarded by disintegrator rays.
Yes, I'd be much more interested in voting for the chief constable of my region, if that were to happen. But don't forget, since this story was broadcast, the law around executions in America has changed so that relatives of the family of any victims of the perpetrator can go in and watch the execution.
Yeah.
But yeah, my friend did get a lot out of it. Like I say, and I think it helped that he didn't have that baggage. And that he could just enjoy laughing at men chasing the doctor down the hallway wearing nappies and things like the doctor jumping shouting, come with me, I'll get the girls, and jumping onto a mobility scooter that sort of meandered down a corridor about 3 miles per hour, which, you know, if he just briskly walked down the corridor, he could have been there in about 3 times the speed.
I don't think we should shy away from saying what I think is quite obvious, which is that it's a great deal of what's wrong with Doctor Who in this period is the fault of the producer. I know there's this campaign to retrospectively celebrate the man, as if to say, you know, imagine if they said, you know, when they announced Chris Chibnall taking over from Stephen Moffat, if the best thing they could have said about him when they announced it was, he'll be really good at getting headlines into the tabloids about the paper.
Yeah.
He'll be really good at publicising it. Oh. Into the paper, sorry. He'll be really good at publicising it. How we'd be thinking, what? You've appointed someone on that
flimsy pretext.
Yeah.
Yeah. He casts as his leading man someone who meets at a party. He decides that to promote the show in America, what's needed is an American companion. Ignoring the fact that, as far as I'm aware, if Americans do like or get Doctor Who, it's because they appreciate its Britishness, not because they want it to be more American. Mm-hmm. But having made that decision, he then casts an English actress and expects her to fake an American accent.
Falls out with one of his best directors, so he can't ever use him again.
Yeah.
It's strange the way that mistake keeps getting made, though, because in the equally execrable League of Extraordinary Gentlemen film, they added a character of Tom Sawyer, specifically so that a supposed American audience would have an American reference point, even though, as you said, if you're going to watch a film about British superheroes in Victorian London, you're probably not going for the American experience. There are enough films set in America. If you're choosing to watch one that isn't, you probably don't need the American linking in.
And Tom Sawyer. It's like casting Joe from Little Women, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. But weirdly, though, the other change they made was to include Dorian Gray, which worked extremely well.
Yes, didn't it? Yeah. But then there's something magic about him.
Yes.
Is that accent good, by the way, this American accent? I know you said it's consistent.
Mm.
I never asked an American. When Scots writer Andrew Smith guested on Diddly Dum, round about episode 27, I did ask him, pluck up the courage to ask him how convincing he found Fraser Hines' Scottish accent as a Scot. And I don't know, he's clearly a man who's been through very many police interviews and can't be caught out with a silly question. But having made all those decisions, J&T then decides her character is going to be that of someone who whines all the time. And that sort of that particular sort of American accent does not go well with whinging.
Rather, it does. It's extraordinarily whingy even when she's not whinging, yeah.
People talk about the atrocity that's the Sixth Doctor's costume, but personally, when I'm having to sit through one of their conversations, like the opening scene in the TARDIS, quite frankly, that coat's quite a welcome distraction for me. And the great pity is, they aren't beyond salvation. You're absolutely right, Hayden. As soon as Colin pops his head out of the TARDIS, the Doctor pops his head out of the TARDIS, and Jason Connery's there, chained to the wall, he says, "Hello!" It's a completely different Doctor.
Yes, it is.
The bit where he says they're processing to the scaffold, he leans over the head of the guy in front of him who's going, and says, "Do you get all the priest parts?" I love it.
What was it he said? We must go up the Purple Passage.
Yes.
Crikey.
And it must have the makings of a good story, because despite all of this, I found myself becoming gradually more and more absorbed by the story.
Yeah.
Not the running around and transmogrifying story, but the political story. Mm. You know when you find yourself sitting very still, almost with your mouth open, watching it, and you realise, oh, I'm taking this really seriously. Reality TV combined with Democracy by TV. There's a lot in here. He's really good and says a lot. And I wonder if, because of the things we've talked about, the lighting, the grey leather pastel-y uniforms, the lack of confidence, we're inclined not to take as seriously as maybe it deserves some of the writing and some of the points that's made. You do get the idea, don't you, that the governeur is the victim here, far more than the proles.
Yeah.
Like Stephen Yardley and Sheila Reid are sitting at home. Stephen Yardley, of course, plays one of my favourite characters in Genesis. Just talking about Genesis, where he plays Severin.
Yes, that's right.
Why can't they kill another creature because it's not in our image? Kill her. It is the law. Oh, no.
She's a gnome.
That sounds quite hello, that, doesn't it? Sorry. It is the law. But Sheila Reid, who plays his wife, appears in Time with the Doctor in Dark Water.
Mm.
It's Clara's gran.
Yeah, of course.
Which I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I must have known it because I've just told you.
I love those little scenes with those two. I know they happen to represent the entire populace of the whole planet, but I love those little scenes.
It's the politics of social media in a way, isn't it? Before we even had social media.
Absolutely.
And what I found interesting is apparently they never met any of the other cast because they filmed all their own scenes in one day.
Well, of course.
Separately. Yeah. And they didn't see any of the actual torture thing that's all supposed to be watching on the TV from home. They actually showed it, apparently, on the screen, on the set, while they were filming. And that was the first they'd seen of it. So they were reacting to it as admittedly, they probably were thinking, oh, that's Jason Connery.
He's quite good at being tortured, though, to be fair. So they might have thought he was really good.
Yes, yes. Mm. And there's a great line by the chief guard, who's obviously the real baddie. The rules must be obeyed by governors as well as prisoners. And the governor says, "What's the difference?" And that's quite good, isn't it? But let's get on. You talked about the Great Nadir, so we move from the Great Nadir to the Great Nabil.
Oh, segue-tastic there.
Doesn't really work, sir. It has to be. In fact, it probably is. The best thing about the show, isn't it? Sill. Or am I in a school of one there?
Well, do you know what? I liked Sill. When I watched this... I watched this 3 or 4 years ago, last time I saw it. I would have agreed with you. But then, during one of his rants, I thought to myself, God, doesn't he sound like Aid Edmondson in The Young Ones? So now all I can picture when Sill is sitting there is sort of Vivian from The Young Ones, ranting and raving. Ah, that is enterprising! But one of the other, I had a visual aid to that comparison as well in the form of that little fin that Syl has reminded me of Vivian's Mohican. we'll have to Photoshop Vivian into a still of Vengeance on Varos, I think.
Or just give Syl the haircut.
Sorry, Mark, go on.
I was going to say, is it because Syl appears with Chris Ryan in
Oh, Lord Kiv. Yes, of course. No, it isn't. No, but it's a brilliant performance. But when you make that kind of comparison, it's just ruined.
Yes, Nabil was a great success when we were watching it. We both thought Nabil was great.
I can't help thinking that the Ferengi, when they came along, were just Syl with sillier ears.
Yes. Because they're also, because like Syl, they are powered by greed, aren't they?
Well, this is it, yeah. But culturally, I thought they were very similar. Not physically.
No. Another thing to put in your log of Doctor Who created everything, Doc.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, possibly. Mm.
Doctor Who invented science fiction.
Please, 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 can we Photoshop Syl into the University Challenge picture of everybody? Just have Syl sitting there in Vivian's place.
And it was very telling in that episode of The Young Ones that Ben Elton wrote himself into Oxbridge Footlights.
Well, isn't that what Alexei Sayle said, didn't he, after that episode? He said that the guys were just interested in the fast cars and the wealth and the fame. They weren't interested in maintaining a movement anymore.
Yeah.
Some podcasters are like that.
Yeah.
John Durr, Jason Connery, is a bit of a puzzle character for me here. I can't work out what he's meant to be. He seems to be written less as a hero, more as an orator.
Mm.
It's a bit like Kemos.
Yes, from the Pirate Planet.
Of the Pirate Planet, who pretends to be brave. He talks a good revolution. But they give him lines like,
this place is where the innocent are tortured, and the population gloats over our efforts to survive.
Yes, it's not dialogue, is it? It's rhetoric.
No.
Yeah.
The viewers applaud and shout with laughter as we poor fools walk towards certain death.
Now, that's not him acting that woodenly, delivering it woodenly.
Those are
deliberately written woodenly.
Yeah, there's no way you can deliver that as if it's human dialogue. The whole thing's done much better. I don't know if anybody's read Interesting Times by Terry Pratchett, but that's set.
No.
But that is set in sort of the Discworld equivalent of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and there is a bit there where the cowardly wizard Rincewind turns to one of the revolutionaries and says, "Listen to me, sunshine. If you ever hear anybody saying, 'Forward, brave comrades,' have a look at them. You'll see they're the one hiding behind a rock wearing the only really arrow-proof helmet."
And I wonder if this thing, something got cut out about a line about Jason Connery's character that explains that. Because if he was Kemos, the Doctor would constantly be sort of swatting him down, wouldn't he?
Or undercutting him with sarcasm he's not smart enough to recognise.
Yeah.
One wonders if Colin Baker's Doctor is a bit fond of a bit of bluster on occasion.
You remember, in Seeds of Doom last time, we asked ourselves at the end, does the Doctor actually do anything?
Mm.
Yes.
At the end of this, they're thanking him for all the help he's done to free them from Syl. What does he actually do?
He talks the governor around, doesn't he? I think that's the main thing. He talks the governor around and then gives the governor the courage to stand up to Syl.
Oh, possibly.
I think the idea is that he's acting as a catalyst for events rather than a motive force.
Yeah.
Mm.
I also don't understand where the vengeance is.
It's the executions, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose so too.
The word vengeance is used quite frequently in the novelisation.
Oh, I'll tell you what I love. You know when the governor goes on TV to torture the people?
Mm.
That little fanfare? is that not the ident from BBC Home Video?
No, it's Ryanair.
I'm sure it is.
You've just aged the podcast, Alan, when we look back at this. We'll just think, oh, I remember when Ryanair was cancelling thousands of flights all the time. Oh, yes, it was the same time that Diddly Dum released their review of Vengeance on Varos.
Good evening.
Could this be a hat-trick for us? we pointed out that the drum roll introduction to both The Young Ones and the all-new Pink Panther show are identical.
Mm-hmm. Once in every lifetime. Think of all the animals you've ever heard about.
We pointed out that the introductory theme music to Mork and Mindy and the introductory theme music to Juliet Bravo are practically identical, except one's played happily and the other's played moodily. Mm-hmm. Have we hit a hat-trick by pointing out that this the Governor's Fanfare is similar to the original VHS fanfare on Doctor Who videos?
Mm.
I think we ought to be told.
It's the sort of cost-cutting measure you can imagine them using, isn't it? Mm. We've got a Doctor Who fanfare, we'll just use it again.
Yeah, but I don't... What Doctor Who videos would have been out by then, though? I mean...
Well, I thought perhaps it would have been the other way around. They'd have sampled the fanfare and
For any fans of Game of Thrones, there's a very young Owen Teal starring.
Oh, nice bloke, Owen Teal.
Alistair Thorne. Really?
Oh, yes! Mm. Yeah, the man on the wall.
He's done loads of things. I met him when he was doing a play in the West End with Sir Ian McKellen and Sir Patrick Stewart. He's absolutely charming. So we remembered Jason Connery to him, and he was very pleased.
Hmm.
He must be good in Game of Thrones, because I hate him in it. I really, really hate... I can take or leave Joffrey. Bastard. One thing I have to criticise, and I'm afraid that this may...
alienate
this
our
may
listeners.
Bring it down from about 2 or 3 points of M marks out of 10, is that the TARDIS is, at the beginning is stuck in a sort of a lay-by in space, isn't it?
Forever.
Midway between the constellations of Cetes and Sculptor. Constellations are not...
No.
Star clusters or galaxies. They're just funny shapes you can draw in the sky, but only from one particular position.
Oh, well, of course, that error is inherent in Doctor Who, because Gallifrey is supposedly in the constellation of Castor.
Exactly.
Now, this is a personal hat-trick for me, because once again, I couldn't be asked to watch the television.
Oh, you...
have read the book instead. You did tell me not to, Doc, but that was yesterday. So I didn't have time to rectify the problem. Besides, I'd already read the book.
Yeah, but surely you have seen it.
So yeah, one time or another, yeah.
Not, it's not like Seeds, where you actually can admit you've never watched it before.
No, never in my life, no. Yeah, and of course I've seen Syl in action in Trial of the Time Lord as well.
I've got to have a word with Erica.
Oh. Can I say, the novel, which is also written by Phil Martin, is utter sh... It's one of the worst written books I've ever had the misfortune to read. It's genuinely terrible.
And then Child Out of Time came out.
Came out. The bar for your achievement is set heroically low, Hayden. I'm going to quote you a sentence I found particularly lovely, and I'm going to read it as the punctuation suggests it should be read.
Okay.
For Syl, the situation was sinking from the bad to the catastrophic. The knowledge that he had blundered and would be held accountable to the unforgiving board of Galatron made the bile and gall of anger and fear swell like a geyser within him before finally erupting into a stream of steaming Thoros-beaten curses with such extreme force and potency that his translational voice box, in an effort to compensate, went into terminal compression in its attempts to hold his wrath to manageable proportions.
Yeah, to quote Alan Partridge, that was just a noise.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? when a 37-year-old man who has read for pleasure all his life is looking at a children's book and going, I don't know what the hell this is supposed to be telling me, you think maybe a redraft would have been in order at some point.
Mm. Who's 37?
Me.
Oh, I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. Loathe and detest you.
I pointed out other little mistakes, like Perry not knowing what poison ivy looks like, although apparently she knows what the Latin name for it is. You think most people probably learn that the other way around, but there we go. But here's another beautiful little quote for you from the actual book itself. And this is one of the most wonderful pieces of vocabulaic prowess I've ever heard in my life. The grasp of language that Philip Martin brings to bear in this paragraph is quite remarkable. It goes a bit like this. Through the trailing creepers, the outline of a bulky figure began to become visible. Very slowly, the doctor advanced, swaying this way and that, carefully, so very carefully, until he emerged safely, to be reunited with Perry in the safe haven that lay between the last ordeal of the end zone and the one safe exit that led out of the punishment dome.
Repetition of safe.
Are we safe? Perry sobbed with relief into the doctor's shoulder.
We're safe,
replied
the doctor.
Quite. So, I mean, it really is a dreadful piece of work. And, you know, we all know these things were shipped out on a tight deadline. But when you're used to reading what Terence Dix does with it, and we've, you know, you yourself, Doc, have made the point many times, essentially what Terence Dick does is just takes the script and turns it into a book, taking the shortest route possible between the two. But he's never come out with anything as outrageously god-awful as that in all his born days. So, it's a truly egregious book. And every time I've heard one of you guys say something in defence of the episode, I've just thought to myself, well, you didn't get that from the book.
Isn't it funny how an episode which is all about violence in the media is actually encouraging violence within one of our co-presenters? Interesting, isn't it? I actually rather like how we watch the TV episode and yet Alan reads the book, because you get a sort of a different feel to as to how the story is in different media, don't you? Really?
That's what I think. I think it's a valuable different perspective.
I do agree, but I do think it's best done when Alan has already seen the episode, even if it was some time ago or something.
So next week we're reading The Web Planet, and Alan is reading the 1965 Doctor Who annual. Alan, what did you make of The Web Planet? Well, I don't know where this John and Gillian turned up from, but still, it's very...
Marks out of 10?
I'm going to give it a 6, I think.
Yes, I think I will get a 6 as well.
I'm quite happy to agree with a 6, provided that if you read it rather than watching it, you bear in mind that score should be cut in half.
I feel a little bit more generous. I'm going to give it a 7.
Oh.
You always have to be different, don't you?
He's the empathic one. He sees the struggle, not the end result.
So, Alan, choose us a story to talk about next time.
Remembrance of the Daleks, I think, please. Go.
Oh, yes. Brilliant.
Also, a good book. Ben Aronovich captured it very well, I felt.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, until next time, faithful sisters.
Don't throw bodies into the river. Blow, blow, blow.
Old soothsayer, old soothsayer. We have enemy ships in Sector 27.
I can see them in the fire. It's a trap.
Happy bye, faithful sisters. Happy bye.
Be seeing you.
Good evening to all. Bye.
Fare thee well.
And if that didn't send you to sleep, faithless listeners. Thank you. There now follows the podcasting forecast, issued by iTunes on behalf of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance at 0100 hours on Friday, the 13th of October, 2017. The general synopsis at midnight. There are warnings of gales of hot air in the following podcasting areas. 42 to Doomsday. Accents poor, becoming unconvincing later. 20 Megabyte. Disused Yeti. Bad Wilf. Crossover Adventure. Cultdom Collective. Blue Box Podcast. Gale Force 9. Becoming political. Diddly Dum Podcast. Occasionally phenomenal. Increasingly grumpy. Perhaps Hurricane Force 12. Target Files. Time and Space. Doctor Hooch. The Doctor Who Show. Star Wars content decreasing rapidly. DWBR Cast. Earth Station Who. Doctor Hooch. Doctor Who's Line Is It Anyway? Acting Fine to Moderate. Earth Station Who. Flight Through Entirety. Gallifrey Public Radio. Gallifrey Stands. Gallifrey's Most Wanted. Geek Syndicate. Geeklectic. Get Off My World. The Happiness Patrol. Deep Southerly. I'll Explain Later. Crinoid. Lazy Doctor Who. Mark Who 42. Minute Podcast. Oodcast. Mostly Made Up. Old Doctor Who Show. The Oncoming Storm. Pharos Project. Podcastica. Podcast with a K. Veering Northeasterly. Terra Nova Backing Off. Roy's Rocket Radio. Sonic Toolbox. Proctor Who. Fine. Occasionally Disco. Staggering Stories. Talking Time Lords. TARDIS Tavern. Radio Free Scaro. Gale Force 9. Snow Expected. Oilers 2. Jets 5. Terminus. Tim's Take. Tin Dog. Transmissions from Atlantis. Trap 1. Travelling the Vortex. Trust Your Doctor. Untempered Schism. Verity. Estrogen. Mild to Gale Force. Waffle On. Wanderers in the Fourth Dimension. Watchathon. Who 37. Who Back When. Who Knew. Who's Doing What. Who's He. Who Cast. Who's On Target. Whostorian. New to Who. Rather Awful. Top Geek. Nerdology. Geeky. Becoming Infrequent. Bigger on the Inside. Complete Menagerie. Time Lash. Big Finish. Eating. Becoming Noisier. Time Scoop. Who and Company. Splendid Chaps. Zeus Pod. Jandals Tramping. Fine to Moderate. And that ends the general synopsis for midnight. And if you got missed out, drop us a line and we'll apologise next time.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.